Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Dave Cushing. Hey, nice to see you again, Lynn. I've been away for about a month, but we're back in the saddle. And I'm eager to jump back on board and meet today's first guest, Dr. Alice Holman, founder of Holman Health here in Park City. Dr. Holman's going to talk with us about the role and benefits of naturopathic medicine, which in part focuses on prevention and the healing power of nature. Sounds really interesting.
Oh, yes. Then we'll be discussing practical parenting techniques with Sarah Ockwell Smith. She is a British mother of four who in the last 5 years has written 6 books designed to help parents manage the challenges of bringing up kids. Her focus is on calming techniques, gentle discipline, and the importance of sleep. This all sounds very good.
Yeah, right you are, Lynn. Well, folks, this is The Mountain Life. Stay with us, and we'll be back after these words.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson from Davidson Orthopedics, proud sponsor of KPCW. We're pleased to announce the opening of our new Park City office in New Park at 1122 Center Drive, right behind Jupiter Bowl. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Hi, Dan Dearden here, owner of Just Right Air and new sponsor of KPCW programming. Just Right Air has been advising Park City area homeowners to repair, replace, and maintain their heating and air conditioning since 2004. Details at justrightair.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Dave Cushing.
Hey.
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 With us now is Dr. Alice Holman. She's the founder of Holman Health in the Prospector neighborhood over on Prospector Avenue behind El Chubasco. Dr. Holman is trained in naturopathic medicine, a distinct primary health care profession, which emphasizes prevention, treatment, and optimal health through the use of therapeutic methods and substances that encourage individuals' inherent healing process. Her clinic also provides acupuncture services. Dr. Holman, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And do you go by Dr. Holman or Alice or Dr. Alice?
Dr. Alice usually fits well, I think.
Hey, Dr. Alice.
I like it.
Thank you.
So, you know, I think it's so interesting, a naturopathic doctor, you're an ND versus an MD, medical doctor, or a DO, doctor of osteopathy.
Yes.
And so as you were talking about off air, is that you all start your medical training the same. So can you describe, you know, how it starts and then how it diverges?
Yeah, so all three types of physicians have to have a four-year degree before they enter medical school. And then in medical school, we all have the same classes in anatomy, biochemistry, physiology, and many, many other classes. And then we all take the same type of boards exam after those 2 years. And then we have an additional 2 years that we focus more in clinicals. So treating patients in a clinical setting under physicians.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. And then for a doctor of osteopathy, how does that, it has to do with clinicals and how you operate in a sort of practical setting?
Yeah, we all have to have the same fundamentals in background in medicine. And then we all branch out into different focuses. So I can't speak so much for osteopaths, but I understand they focus more on the spine.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's just their focus or balance. Whereas naturopaths look to treat the whole person, and our training focuses a lot on nutrition and counseling, and of course the sciences. But also we have a lot of classes in botanical medicine, in homeopathy, and other types of natural medicines after our core sciences. So really looking to treat the whole person and integrate the whole person's health and wellness, looking at their mental health, their spiritual health, and everything about their body. So bringing it all together mm-hmm. for them and teaching. You know, the Latin word root of doctor is docere, and that's teacher. So really the doctor should be teaching you about your health and spending the time to teach you about your health. That's really important, I think. A lot of us have so many questions and concerns, and they don't want a short visit. Typical visits with a naturopathic doctor are a half an hour to an hour as opposed to 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Hey, what led you into this career in the day?
Yeah, so I was at University of Washington in my undergraduate, and I was doing a side job. I swam for University of Washington, and I had to make some money as well. And so I worked for Department of Family Medicine and met a lot of the doctors who decided who got into medical school. And they said, you would be a great doctor. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting, because my grandfather was a doctor and my great-grandfather was a doctor. So it fit. But then I also that same year met somebody who was graduating from Bastyr University, where I went to medical school. And that light bulb just went off. It was just one of those lucky, rare times, I think, in a person's life where you just know exactly what you want to do.
Right. And Bastyr is one of the colleges, one of the universities in the United States that naturopathic physicians get trained at. Am I right?
Yes. When I was going to medical school, Bastyr was one of two naturopathic medical schools. And so the other one was in Portland, Oregon. Bastyr is in mm-hmm. Seattle, Washington. And then National College, which is now called National University of Naturopathic Medicine, I believe, in Portland. And now there are at least three other ones in the state or in the United States.
Wow. Yeah. Only that many.
Yeah.
And not many of you in the state of Utah, you mentioned.
Exactly. So I come from Washington State. I lived here for 2 years. And in Utah, there are approximately 20 naturopathic doctors. And in Washington, there are hundreds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, when you went to medical school, it was probably before the time where the word integrative medicine was all over the place. And it would seem to me, and it does, I know this to be true, that if a medical doctor right now is not practicing sort of an integrative approach to health, they're kind of behind the times. They're a little bit archaic. But but back when you decided on medical school, you decided on naturopathy. Naturopathy, however you say it.
Yeah, however you want to say it.
Because that sort of appealed to you, the whole person.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And it really only, as you describe it, it really only makes logical sense to me. But I know that that hasn't really necessarily been the tradition. It's like you get sick and then we make you well by doing these things. But the whole preventative aspect of health maybe was left out. And this is a big part of what you do.
Yeah, that's a huge focus of a naturopathic physician, is prevention. Instead of just coming for a yearly exam, a lot of patients see me several times during the year.
Yeah. How much resistance do you get? Well, I would imagine a patient who's coming to a naturopathic doctor already is very willing to look at other aspects of their lives that may be making them ill.
Exactly.
But I would imagine you still get some resistance. Like, you know, okay, I know I need to slow down, but I can't. Sorry, I can't slow down. You know, my life is my life. And so I've mm-hmm. just got to deal with what's making me sick.
That's a good point.
But I want to have integrative health.
Exactly. And it's been a learning process for me just to meet the patient where they are ready to be met. And
right.
that's, you really need to find that out during the interview, because some people are ready to change their diet and start exercising and change everything about their health. And some people are really just willing to change one thing. And that one thing may be so powerful for them that changes the rest of their whole health picture.
What's an example of one of those things that a patient has changed and really taken them down a nice pathway?
Well, I think, you know, maybe a patient that has gastrointestinal issues and they're taking pills to help with, you know, gas, bloating, diarrhea, and you can just say, can you just stop and chew your food when you're eating and not just swallow it whole? I mean, this is just so basic.
Right.
And that comes back to that doctor as teacher, just educating people about their bodies or, you know, just changing one certain food. A lot of people talk about gluten intolerance. What is that? You know, what? How is food affecting me? How is the food in our environment affecting us? You know, if you can have foods that have less pesticides and colorings, how does that affect my body? So just very simple changes.
Yeah.
In reviewing some of the material from the Association of Naturopathic Medicine online that you provided beforehand, the definitions are pretty interesting, some of the major aspects. And one of them is fascinating to me, which is to help people stimulate the self-healing mechanism, because our bodies have amazing powers to make things right. But how do you work with people to stimulate these things?
Well, you know, very, very basically, are you drinking pure water, clean water? Are you breathing clean air? Are you breathing? Are you drinking enough? Are you eating properly? But then you can go beyond that and work with plant medicine or botanical medicine to help the immune system function better. You can do hydrotherapy or acupuncture to help the immune system work better. Lots of things.
Do you have a background or in like herbal medicine or Chinese herbal medicine, or how is that field defined and how is that applied to modern life?
So botanical medicine is part of our training in naturopathic medicine. And so I'll use a lot of herbal medicines instead of pharmaceuticals first. If pharmaceuticals are needed, then I'll definitely recommend those.
You're licensed to prescribe?
Some things in this state, yes.
Oh, in this state.
Yes.
So in Washington, for example, where you come from, is it different? Are you able to prescribe a greater range?
A greater range, definitely. Very, very close to that of a medical doctor.
Uh-huh.
So it's very state by state, definitely.
Right. And so, and there are a lot of differences between how a naturopathic doctor is just the whole world that you operate in as a naturopathic doctor in a state like Washington versus Utah. And one of those things I think you mentioned is that your insurance will cover it in Washington.
Yes.
Not necessarily so in Utah, or how does it... How does that whole insurance thing work? Because I think for me, that in the past is what has kept me from having a naturopathic doctor as my primary care physician. My insurance, either, I don't know, maybe I have to do a little bit more work to get my insurance to cover it.
Yeah, it really comes down to you submitting the bill and being the squeaky wheel with the insurance company, because there are so few of us, so few naturopaths in the state, there isn't the lobbying money to fight that insurance situation right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what are your specialties? I know that you're an acupuncturist as well. And is that part of a naturopathic medical degree? Because I know other naturopaths that are also acupuncturists.
It's a whole separate degree. So I took, so I have my medical degree, and I also at the same Bastyr University studied acupuncture, which was a whole separate 3-year program. So out of 140 of us in medical school in my class, there were 5 of us who did both programs. So I also do acupuncture with a lot of my patients. They may come in for a blood draw and to review labs and have a physical exam, but also maybe they're having headaches or stress or hormone imbalances or back pain that we can treat with acupuncture. So it's lovely to marry all of the resources.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Alice Holman, naturopathic doctor here in Park City on Prospector Avenue. in the same office as Dr. Babby Lester and Dr. Jared Nielsen.
That's
who is Jared Nielsen's a chiropractor. Babby Lester is also an ND.
Yes.
Right. Now, what's the breakdown men versus women in your practice? Namely, the patients.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think mostly women come to the doctor. They're more interested in treating their health from what I've seen so far. I have the majority female patients, but I see a lot of men as well.
Right. And do you work in conjunction with OBGYN doctors as well, or can you provide a lot of those services?
I can also do OBGYN services, gyn exams, and hormone balancing, but I definitely refer to other doctors as needed, whether it be an OB-GYN or a gastroenterologist or endocrinologist. So I don't have all the answers, and so many doctors are needed to treat the whole person.
How do you build a network of traditional MDs when you come to town as a ND?
Good question. I think it's just all about getting out there and meeting people, you know, just going to different meetings in town and getting up out on the ski hill. I've met a lot of practitioners as well. So just getting out of the office.
You mean lift chatting?
Oh, yeah.
Right. It works, doesn't it?
It sure does.
What a network. Way to network in this town.
Yeah, what brought you to Park City? Seattle's a pretty nice place.
Well, I had been in Seattle area my whole life, and I just wanted to change, and I love the mountains, I love the fresh air, and I love the small town.
Yeah.
So it's
Seattle's
great to be here.
Seattle's not so small.
Not anymore.
Really? Hey, one of the things on the website also is interesting because it gets at our national problem called opioid addiction. And when it comes to treating pain, a naturopath has a different perspective than going right to an opioid prescription. Can you talk about that and break that down a little bit?
Definitely. So there are so many things you can do to help pain, even changing your diet. So if you have a lot of inflammation, you're going to be in quite a bit of pain. So we can change diet. We can look at other pain relievers instead. I use a lot of acupuncture for pain relief. There are whole clinics that actually specialize in pain relief and getting patients off of their drugs because it stimulates those same chemicals that make your brain feel good. Yeah. And high. All this is the serotonin and norepinephrine and all kinds of neurochemicals that make you feel good and less pain.
So if you are someone who has issues with addiction and, you know, it is such a scary world out there when, you know, my son, for example, had surgery last year and you know, it was the first thing I said, no opioids,
yeah.
No. And they, you know, insisted on prescribing that. And that is, I mean, it's understandable that the mission is to manage pain and that's what is done. But it seems like a really broad new world that you could open up a lot of patients to because there is such a crisis in this country on opioid addiction.
Exactly. So I see a lot of patients who refuse opioids as well, and they say, hey, what can you do for me? And we work with their pain. In other countries, they just use botanicals and acupuncture for pain relief, even with surgery.
Wow.
You can believe that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
If a patient has started on opioid pain management meds, can you help them make a transition?
I can in conjunction with their medical doctor, definitely.
Right. Hmm.
Jumping from opioids to, I want to go back to talk a little bit about women's health. Where are you on the hormone replacement and bioidenticals? And maybe you could explain a little bit about your approach.
Definitely. So you can look at patients' blood labs and also salivary labs, and you can also look at hormones through urine testing. But whatever it is, just finding out what's going on with the patient. And if the patient definitely wants to have hormone replacement therapy, I can prescribe that. And I tend to go more for a natural form that's more plant-based versus from horse urine, which is the conventional type of hormone replacement therapy. It's based in animal urine, actually. So, some patients just need some balancing of their organs. So if they're very tired, their adrenal glands might be out of balance, and we can work with that with botanicals and glandulars. And sometimes liver is out of balance and needs some detoxification. And sometimes a liver that is very toxic can give more hot flashes in a certain manner. So just balancing the organs first and then working with hormone therapy if needed.
Oh, very interesting. And so how often can you, I mean, if someone is really committed to clearing up their issues with their organs and their, for example, in menopause and having hot flashes, how often does that completely go away without having to address it with hormone replacement?
I haven't seen any studies on that, but just with my own patients, most people are willing to try other things besides medications first, and they see success maybe in about a month or so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Getting back to pain, you know, this is a town of recreational and extreme athletes. And in one sense, this town runs on Ibu, right? I never knew that word until I got here a couple of years ago. Ibuprofen.
Give me
some Ibu. Right. So we know that that can have some long-term consequences. Can you address ibuprofen and alternatives to ibuprofen for our recreational athletes out there?
Yeah, definitely. So I don't know, most people are aware that NSAIDs or ibuprofen would definitely affect the kidney and the liver, so they're toxic. So I've seen a lot of athletes in my practice, and you can actually have kidney and liver damage from taking too much of that. So I address pain with botanical medicine of all kinds, turmeric, curcumin, bromelain are all very helpful herbs, but also acupuncture is very, very powerful. I also do an injection therapy that is an alternative to corticosteroid injections.
Oh, and what is that? Is that made up of turmeric? And
it's a type of injection with B12 and procaine. Procaine is a pain reliever, but it's actually strongly anti-inflammatory and was used for that in the 1900s in Germany when it just came out.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you about an anti-inflammatory diet. You know, you were saying earlier that you like to meet your patients where they are. And, you know, I've attempted an anti-inflammatory diet, and very often it's like all the fun things to eat are inflammatory and drink. So what are the couple things that, you know, the easy things that someone who is listening right now might do to take away the inflammation if they want to just start small?
Pretty basic, you know, just getting off the alcohol and coffee. Just two basic things, but there are a lot of foods that are common food allergens and sensitivities for people that are gluten, dairy, eggs, soy. So you just have to figure out what you're sensitive to, and you can do that via food allergy testing with the blood, or you can do an elimination diet to figure out what you're sensitive to.
Yeah. Wow.
Hey, to what extent do naturopaths prescribe medical marijuana in states where that's available?
In Washington State, you can prescribe medical marijuana, definitely, but you can acquire it, I think, you know, other ways.
Right. Yeah. And it's something that you would commonly prescribe, or do you find that there are other botanicals that are more effective?
Right. Is that something you receive training in
definitely we have training in that, but it's a bit controversial because of the national, it's illegal nationally.
Right.
So.
And maybe the lack of clinical-based evidence. Clinical studies on marijuana? Or is there a raft of that?
Oh, there's so much evidence there. Mm. But I think there are a lot of practitioners that are afraid to actually prescribe it. Just because of
until it becomes
it's nationally legal. Mm-hmm. But we're getting there state by state.
Yeah.
It's becoming legal. Oh. But in Washington State, it was legal to prescribe that.
What were some of the key indicators for medical marijuana prescriptions in Washington State?
Any intractable pain, severe pain that's not treated by any other means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Hey, we have just a couple minutes left, and I want to be sure, because it's fall allergy season again.
Right.
And it's funny, we were just talking about this, and I was thinking, I've felt off for the last week, and it just occurred to me it might be allergies instead of this horrible cold I thought I had. So talk about how naturopathic physicians address allergies and how you do, because you suffer from allergies.
I do. So one of the biggest things that helped me is just to get off my food sensitivities. So dairy and gluten are big for me. And when I start eating those again, I have a lot of allergy trouble, sneezing and itchy eyes. Also, there are botanicals that are helpful for that, like nettles, stinging nettles in a pill form.
Oh.
You think that they're just dangerous and painful, but they're actually really, really helpful and full of vitamins and minerals. People add them to soups, and if you don't want to do that, you can put it in a capsule.
Wow.
But also bromelain and quercetin are other supplements that help with allergies.
Bromelain, you used that word a couple times
mm-hmm.
today.
And acupuncture is great for allergies.
Great.
So if I'm an occasional user of, what's the common inhaler?
Nasacort.
Yeah. Non-prescription, right? Is that non-prescription? Is that over-the-counter? Whatever.
I think it may be over-the-counter now.
Yeah, it used to be.
It used to be just
that
prescription.
Plus Claritin is what I need on a few times a month during allergy season. What would be the equivalent or the replacement in the naturopathic world?
Actually, just what we talked about.
Just now, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Same.
Yeah,
thing.
And you just have to be careful about taking in too much steroid. You're talking about the Nasacort.
Right.
Because that will affect your whole body. Cortisone throws your blood sugar out of balance and your immune system as well. So it's something you don't want to be taking all the time without
right.
some long-term side effects.
Yeah.
Good point.
Dr. Alice Holman, we're so glad you could come. We could keep you on the whole hour.
Well,
but
thank you so much.
You probably have other work to do.
Right.
Patients
and it was,
to see.
You were here a year ago with Tim. And so thanks for getting through our annual naturopathic update.
I appreciate you very
so
much.
How does someone find you if they'd like to do that?
My phone number is 435-615-2020. And you can also see my website at holmanhealth.com, H-O-L-M-A-N health.com.
Excellent. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank
Fabulous.
You.
I'm feeling better already.
Have a healthy day.
Oh, I'm feeling like I have to give up coffee and alcohol. And
donuts.
Yeah, donuts. And I wanted to dare you, Dave. You know, there's a lot of stinging nettle on the trail out here. I dare you to just start chomping on a few leaves and see if it
Yeah, I'll pull some up and flagellate myself. How's that sound?
Sounds good. And we'll be back after these words from our underwriters. You're listening to The Mountain Life.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
Hey, this is Nick Spitzer. Join me here on KPCW for American Roots, our weekly two-hour music program from New Orleans. We bring you a wide range of American music, Sunday mornings at 11 a.m., supported by Donna Van Buren and Greater Park City Properties. American Roots, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
And welcome back to The Mountain Life on KPCW in Park City. This is Dave Cushing riding shotgun, or rather wingman, to Lynn Ware Peak. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, Dave.
Well, we are going to transition to our next guest now, who was born 40-some years ago in Bedfordshire, England, east of London. Her name is Sarah Ockwell Smith, and she studied psychology in college and worked in pharmaceutical research and development before she became pregnant with her first child in the year 2001 at age 25. And as a new mom, she trained as an antenatal teacher, a hypnotherapist, psychotherapist, developmental infant massage instructor, and birth/postnatal doula. She's also updated her knowledge with pediatric first aid, safeguarding, perinatal psychology, and birth trauma. And she writes parenting books, 6 of them in the last 5 years, with 2 more on the way. So welcome to the mountain life, Sarah.
Thank you. I think it's good morning with you, isn't it?
It is. It's about 9:30, quarter of 10 here. And
fantastic. It's what, evening here.
Yeah. What a fantastic flurry of activity you've been involved in for the last 16 years since your first child came. Well, what launched you into this particular path you've chosen, namely writing about how parents can cope with the challenges of bringing up kids?
I think, you know, you've done a great job reading out all of the professional qualifications I have, but really it was having my own kids. You know, I don't know if you have kids or readers listening who are parents. It kind of changes everything. I look to experts, to books, to help me when I have my children, like lots of other parents, and nothing quite felt right. So really, it started, I think my first book I really wrote it for myself kind of 8 years previously. And what I was really looking for was something that validated the instincts that I had. Everything I had read made me feel like a bad mum. It made me feel like I wasn't doing it right. So I kind of started off by filling a gap that I had when I had my firstborn.
Right. So 11 years after your firstborn, 10 or 11 years, you published a book called Baby Calm. And that led to Toddler Calm, and that led to a series of gentle books. So your philosophy seems to be about keeping things calm and gentle and while raising kids. That sounds like a pretty good place to start.
Uh-huh. So it's kind of really about having respect for kids. A lot of parenting methods that have come out in the last 100 years almost treat children like they're the enemy. We're still very much stuck in Victorian authoritarian parenting, you know, lots of punishment and chastising and shaming. And I don't think it works. Well, I don't think it works as well as society thinks it does. Really simply, I think if you want children to behave better, you have to treat them better. You have to make them feel good. It's that simple.
So we seem to go from one side to the other. You know, we were authoritarian parents, and then that gave way to permissive parenting. And now we've seen permissive parenting doesn't really work because in the end, you know, children need structure. And so I'm thinking that with your new book, Gentle Discipline, you've come up with a way to sort of a hybrid method. Well, I wouldn't say you use authoritarianism, but you know what I'm getting at, this sort of keeping kids within a structure, but doing it in a kind and gentle and respectful way.
Exactly that. So there are 3 main styles of parenting that psychologists recognize. There's authoritarian parents, so that's the very strict Victorian parents. There's the permissive parents that you speak of. And in the middle, there's a style called authoritative. It's quite hard to say, actually, and very often gets confused with authoritarian. When I reference the word gentle, what I really mean is authoritative parenting. So it's kind, it's respectful, but it's not permissive. There are rules, there are boundaries, and there's discipline because, you know, permissive parenting is not good for anybody.
Right. Yeah. And what are some of the pitfalls that you've seen with permissive parenting? I mean, it seems even some schools, some early education schools kind of modeled themselves after this permissive parenting where the child decides what they want to do and what they want to learn, not the teacher or not the parent.
I think the 2 biggest problems with permissive parenting is very often they overestimate children. That sounds a bit silly, but I think sometimes the parents who follow that style presume that the kids are capable of more than they actually are without adult guidance. Secondly, I don't think kids thrive in permissiveness. They need to have those boundaries around them. They need to have them to feel safe, to understand what's expected of them. So letting kids take control is brilliant, but there are some things, you know, it's not great to give them control over. Give them control over what's age appropriate and what's safe for them and what fits in with the family. But sometimes I think we need to be less afraid of taking back control. It's not non-gentle to take control as a parent or as a teacher even.
Well, another thing your bio states about you is that you know a lot about what's called attachment parenting and co-sleeping. Can you tell me and our listeners about those aspects of your philosophy?
So attachment parenting is a very new thing. It came about in the 70s or 80s by William Sears and Martha, his wife.
Yes.
What I talk about is attachment theory. So that actually predates attachment parenting by a good kind of 40 years. So we're looking at the work of John Bowlby and Winnicott and Ainsworth. So these are psychologists who were working around the time of the Second World War, and they were looking at the impact of children being deprived of their parents. So whether their parents had died in the war, whether the parents were fighting, whether their children had been sent away to somewhere more safe. They looked at what happened to kids, when they, young kids in particular, so particularly under threes, without their parents around. So this field of research has been very prominent really since the 1940s and 50s. Attachment parenting takes this much further, and we start to look at things like how you feed your baby. So, for instance, promoting breastfeeding, carrying a baby in a sling, it's called baby wearing. Attachment theory doesn't really prescribe how you take care of a child. It just talks about that essential bond between parent or caregiver and child. Really, in essence, allowing the child to be emotionally attached to the parent for as long as they need be. So it basically says that you can't force independence. The best way to create an independent and confident child is to be there for them when you need them, when they need you, sorry.
Right. So your four children were attached to you for these number of years before you started writing. And finally, when they got off you a little bit, that's when you could get down and start churning out these books, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be a physical attachment. So I have bed shared with my babies, with three out of the four. It sounds a bit weird in New Age, but actually around the world, 70% of families bed share. If you look at Asia, they just don't do crib.
Yeah.
They all sleep in a big family bed. So I have one baby who really didn't want to be touched very much, and he slept in his crib, in his own room very early on. That's what I mean when we're talking about attachment. It's following the baby's lead. So if they need to be really attached, that's great. But if they need their space, then you honor that as well.
I think to a lot of cultures who do have the family bed, they think it is very strange that the parents go in one room and they get to sleep together while this poor defenseless baby has to be banished to its own room all by itself. When you describe it that way, it does sound weird.
It does.
There are so many cultures that think the UK and the US, Canada, are just strange around nighttime parenting practices. There's a really famous research study stemming from quite deep in South America. And they were asking the South Americans for traditional villages about their sleep setups. And they all shared a bed or shared a room. And they asked them if they'd done sleep training or had any problems with the baby's sleep. And they were saying to the researchers, well, we don't understand what that means. What's a sleep problem? What's sleep training? And they just thought it was really strange that in North America, these parents were sleeping their kids separate from them from a very early age, and they were struggling with sleep because it just wasn't part of their culture. They didn't understand why people had a problem with sleep and why you would put the baby away from you.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think it's weird and new age, but, it's, you know, for as long as humans have been here, we've bedshared, we've co-slept.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you this, and I'll just go ahead and admit, we did the family bed. My kids are grown now, but one of the issues with it, I mean, it just made so much sense to me for the same reasons you described, but my kids never really slept through the night until, I don't know, until they were like 3 years old. So talk about that, because I know you're really into sleep as well and the importance of children getting a good night's sleep.
Yeah. So what's quite interesting is what we think we know about sleep is pretty much wrong. Research actually suggests that babies or toddlers won't sleep through the night until they're somewhere between 2 and 4 years of age. To expect it to happen sooner is bad science, but actually, you and I as adults, we don't sleep through the night. We never have, we never will do. We all sleep in cycles. So for a baby, a sleep cycle is about 40 minutes. For you and I, our sleep cycles are about 90 minutes. So basically what that means is the baby will be awake, they'll go to sleep, they'll pass through different phases of sleep, so a lighter sleep to a medium sleep to a deeper sleep, and then they'll start to wake up again. Now that whole sleep cycle takes 40 minutes. So let's say you put them to bed at 7 and they wake at 7, they've got something like 15 or 16 sleep cycles to go through. Nobody just goes to sleep at night and wakes in the morning. Now, what happens at the end of a sleep cycle is if there is anything in that baby's world that makes them uncomfortable or anxious, maybe they're hungry, maybe they're too hot, maybe they're too cold, maybe they're thirsty, maybe they're missing you, maybe they've slept in a position that's made them uncomfortable. At the end of that sleep cycle, I call it the danger zone. If they wake and there's something wrong in that danger zone, they're going to wake and pretty much need their parents' help to get back to sleep again. If there's nothing wrong, then they'll start a new sleep cycle. When we talk about babies sleeping through the night, what we really mean is that baby has independently connected about 15 sleep cycles. You know, that's quite a lot. We don't do it. You know, last night I woke up at about 2 a.m. to have a drink of water. Maybe the night before that I went up to go to the toilet. You know, as adults, we wake in the night. The key difference is when we wake, whatever our problem is, we can usually fix it. So if we have a headache, we can go and take a Tylenol. If we need to go to the toilet, we can go. If there's a noise, we can investigate. If we have a nightmare, we can breathe and tell ourselves that it's not real. But if you think about a nine-month-old baby, they're pretty helpless. They can't fix things for themselves. They need our help. So a baby who wakes regularly is just a baby who needs a little bit more help. Maybe they're a little bit more sensitive. None of them will sleep through the night. It's not a good thing that you put the baby to sleep at 7 and you don't see from it until 7 in the morning. That baby won't have had more sleep overall than the baby who's seemingly woken 6 times. So I think the way you look at it, you know, it's confusing. We put a lot of pressure onto parents. Lots of parents struggle with quite how much babies wake and how much input they need because there's such an unrealistic portrayal in the media and books and magazines on the internet. And such a pressure to get them sleeping through. But actually, it's of no benefit to the babies. The people who benefit from a baby waking less are the parents. It's not an issue for the baby to wake more.
That's amazing stuff. And I guess so true. Now, let's turn to your current book, Gentle Discipline, which looks fascinating. And it's a U.S. version of your Gentle Discipline book, right, from the U.K.
Yes.
And then on your website, your current blog post, which just came out yesterday, was super fascinating, the three biggest mistakes parents make when disciplining children. And I wonder if you could just walk us through the three things: overestimating children, the fix-it mentality, and taking supposed failures personally. They all really rang true to me.
Yes, so many parents will say to me, Sarah, I've tried all of these methods you suggest, all of these discipline methods, and you know what? My two-year-old still tantrums all the time or still hits his baby sister. So the three biggest problems that we have to think about is, firstly, are we expecting behavior that's just not appropriate for that age? So two, the brain is about 30% developed of what it will be as an adult. The last things that connect up in the brain are the centers of emotion regulation and impulse control. So basically, you or I, if we're really angry, we'll know that it's wrong to hit or curse. We could try to control our temper. We can control our impulses and control our emotions. Although sometimes, I think all adults will admit they're not good at it all of the time. That ability comes in normally around the early 20s, so 20, 21, 22. Toddlers can't do that. They can't control their impulses and they can't control their emotions. It doesn't matter what discipline technique you use. They're still a toddler. So we have to stop expecting a toddler with a toddler brain to behave like an adult. It's not a failure of the discipline method. You're just working with a child who has a very different brain to you.
So when there's a tantrum going or some hitting going on, then how do you approach it using a gentle discipline philosophy?
So if there's hitting coming, the first thing I talk about in any form of discipline is safety. So if whoever they're hitting, you need to move them away. So if they're trying to hit their baby sister, you've got two options. You move the toddler or you move the baby. Sometimes you might have to carefully restrain them. move them to somewhere that's safe, move them away from objects. At that point, once you've moved them and other people, objects, and the toddler themselves are safe, usually the best thing to do then is to just support them silently. By that I mean just standing with them or sitting a little way away from them so that they're comfortable with you being there but you're not too close, and just allow them to release their emotions, because that is all a tantrum is. It's good then to help empathize, to say to the toddler, I can see that you're angry or you're sad. By naming the emotions, it shows that you're understanding what they're feeling. But really importantly, it helps them to learn what those emotions are, so that hopefully somewhere down the line, they can say to you, Mama, I'm angry. Help me calm down, rather than have the tantrum. Ultimately, when it finishes, it's not the time to tell them off or the time to chastise them. They haven't done anything wrong. They're just a toddler and they can't control how they feel. So at that point, I try to give them a hug. I do something nice with them, play a game or something. And then when they're calm, and only when they're calm, talk to them about how the baby may have felt, how they were feeling, and what they could do better next time. Despite all of that, though, this is the next point with my three big problems parents make. Despite all of that, the next point is that we have this tendency to want to fix everything, i.e. if we have a toddler that tantrums, we just want to stop them tantruming. We want to fix the tantrums and, you know, that's it, done and dusted, they don't happen anymore. Again, though, that's not realistic. You can't stop a toddler tantruming. You can minimize the damage they do, and you can teach them over time, by time I'm talking months and years, to behave in a better way, but you can't stop that behavior. Something I'm often asked is, my toddler keeps trying to grab these precious ornaments off of my fireplace. What can I do? If I say no, they don't listen. So I talk about not fixing things, but using your adult brain to step outside the situation. In that case, rather than thinking about fixing it and stopping it, the simplest answer is move them. Put them in a locked cupboard, put them up high. We spend so much trying to fix things, we miss the obvious solution. And my really last point in those three mistakes parents make is to stop taking everything so personally. All kids misbehave, all kids have tantrums, all kids curse, all kids go through a phase of biting, hitting or kicking. It's nothing parents have or haven't done personally. I think there's so much information for parents now. If we're not perfect, if we're not Instagram worthy all the time, I think we can feel really guilty and really down and lacking in confidence.
Right.
A lot of the time, which it's just about not taking things personally, you know, realizing you really are doing your best. And sometimes the best thing you can do, ironically, I shouldn't be saying this since I want to sell a book, but sometimes the best thing you can do is not read the book, not listen to the experts, and just chill out of it. Not worry about being this great parent all the time. Have fun with them instead. Go play football or something. Stop worrying about the discipline.
Right. You talked about taking a parenting break occasionally. Could you elaborate on what you mean by a parenting break?
When things aren't going well, so parents are trying desperately to discipline and to stop a certain behavior, they're reading lots of different information, they're trying to put it all into practice and take it on board, sometimes it gets completely overwhelming, not just for the child, but for the parents too. When you're overwhelmed, when you're reaching, I call it parenting burnout, nothing's going to go well. You know, parents are going to get really stressed. When you've got low confidence as a parent, when you're really anxious and stressed, then you find it hard to control your impulses and your emotions. You end up yelling or doing something you don't feel particularly proud of. You're not going to solve anything when you're stuck in that situation. So sometimes we talk about in discipline, well, I don't talk about, other people talk about giving children a time out. I don't agree with time out from that perspective. What I do agree with is parents taking a time out. Take a time out from trying to be this perfect parent. So literally put the books away. Stop worrying about what your kid's doing. Stop worrying about how you're reacting. And just have fun for a couple of days. Don't read parenting books. Go and read a romance book or a horror or a thriller. Don't watch parenting TV programs. Go and watch a sitcom that makes you laugh. And just relax a bit. You know, I think the worst thing about our generation is there is so much information out there telling us how to parent. 200 years ago, it wasn't, parenting wasn't even a thing.
Right.
It certainly didn't have a definition.
Right. Well, now we have fewer kids, you know, and so we have fewer chances to make really great kids. And so I think that's why we sort of get into the over-parenting and the, you know, big, the preoccupation with parenting correctly. And that leads me into my final question, which is about helicopter parenting. You know, we're told that there are these college students arriving to college. They're not resilient. They don't know how to do anything for themselves. They're infinitely smart, but they really can't operate in the world because they've been over-parented. And so when you're dealing with young kids, as you're sort of, you've written this book for the younger set, you know, tell us how to navigate that portion of it.
I think one of the things we spoke about earlier, attachment is important. So allowing the child to attach when they need you.
Yeah.
So when allowing your child as much of you as they need. But the really important thing is you then have to let go. And I think some parents don't do that or find it harder. So attachment is all about allowing the child to attach, but it's really importantly about the detaching as well. So the letting go and letting them go out into the world, that can be really hard. I think, as you say, we have less children, we want to do it right. But also, it's such a thankless task. You know, stay-at-home parents are often treated like second-class citizens. Like we think, oh, you're a stay-at-home parent because you can't go and get a good job. You don't get appraisals for being a parent. So it's hard to let go. Gentle discipline, gentle parenting, it is all about letting go as well as the attaching. The other thing that we don't do enough of is letting our kids make mistakes. I think if you think about all the overscheduling, if they're going in for their exams or wanting to get into college, we want them to do well. But actually, sometimes it's more valuable to let them slip up.
Yeah.
Huh. And I think sometimes it takes a lot of confidence as a parent. And a lot of my work talks about having good self-esteem and good confidence and lots of self-care to allow your children to detach, to allow them to make mistakes, to allow them to cry, actually. Not making them cry because you're too harsh on them, but to allow it as a valid emotion. All of that sort of adds up in little puzzle pieces to hopefully reduce helicopter parenting and allow them to go into the world confident and resilient.
Oh, that's great. Good stuff. I really am so glad that you could join us today. Our guest, Sarah Ockwell Smith, and her new book, one of her many books that she's written in the last decade or so, it's Gentle Discipline. It's all about using emotional connection and not punishment. And we're so glad that you could join us, Sarah. Thank you for being here.
Best wishes.
Thank you for having me.
On your next couple of books too. Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after these words.
Catch the high-flying action every Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m., beginning June 25th and running through September 3rd with the Flying Ace All-Stars Freestyle Show. See Olympians and national team skiers and snowboarders soar up to 60 feet in the air before landing in the park's Spence Eccles Olympic Freestyle Pool. A great show for the whole family, this half-hour choreographed production will leave you breathless.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.